mixed with gall. It's actually not known what gall is. We think it was probably some kind of herbal preparation that dulled pain. But the word gall usually implies something bitter. For whatever reason, after he tastes this, he decides not to drink it. Some people think it's because Jesus chose to experience all the pain of the crucifixion for us. Others suggest that maybe it's because Jesus felt the drug was more poisonous than helpful. Some even think it might be a reference to Psalm 69, verse 21, in which David, talking about and his enemies, said, "They put gall in my food and gave me vinegar for my thirst." In any case, this moment encapsulates the bitterness of the experience. Bitter that Jesus had come to this dark place and yet been abandoned by those closest to him. The disciples had expected a savior, but it doesn't seem to have occurred to them that this is what a savior would look like. Bitter that as he took the sins of those who were crucifying him, they only mocked and jeered. Bitter that in this, the darkness, the darkest of times, in which he really wanted to experience the Father's love, his Father turned away. Even the sign that was placed above his head, saying in multiple languages, "King of the Jews," was bitter in its irony. For here, the person hanging on the cross really was the King of the Jews. Yet they, like everyone else, had rejected him. The sign told the truth. The story of the crucifixion is well known to Christians and non-Christians alike. The moments and beats in this story are rich in significance and meaning and bitterness. Take, for example, the jeers of those on the ground around the cross. No doubt many of them thought they were just being funny, if a little cruel. But when people called out, "Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God," they unknowingly hit on the very heart of the matter. It was exactly because Jesus was the Son of God, ironically, and because he alone understood what was at stake, that Jesus could not come down from the cross. He understood that only by allowing death to do its worst on him could he defeat it once and for all. And in the same way, when the chief priest snidely remarked that he saved others but he couldn't save himself, they accidentally realized the reality that Jesus could either complete his mission and save others, or he could save himself. He had to choose one or the other. Most ironic of all, they declare that if he comes down from the cross, then and only then will they believe in him. Well, if they truly believed in him and understood what he was doing, they'd have understood that coming down from the cross was simply not a possibility for Jesus. Once again, there was bitterness in the irony. There is darkness in the story, both literally and figuratively. Literally in that the sun was blocked out by some kind of cloud or other obstruction. Figuratively in that this was likely the worst moment of Jesus' life. The writers of the Gospels talk about this as a real, literal event, but it also has a spiritual dimension. 10 chapters before, in Matthew chapter 17, Jesus takes Peter, James, and John up onto a mountain where he is transfigured in front of them. And in this incident, Jesus is obscured by a bright cloud, indicative of the glory of God. But here, the cloud isn't bright, it's dark. It shows us that God's glory has left this terrible scene. If we were any doubt of this, Jesus cries out from the cross, quoting Psalm 22:1 in Aramaic, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," which translates as, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Why would God forsake the Son that he's repeatedly shown to love so greatly? At this moment, Jesus is the embodiment of the world's sin. Every act of rebellion, every moment of hate, every refusal to do right, and yes, every time that you and I have done something we knew that we shouldn't do. As Jesus hangs on the cross, that sin is on him. The bitter cup of humankind is drained to its very dregs. God is the incarnation of love, but he is also the incarnation of justice. And so he turns away. And Jesus, who has never known a moment away from his Father, feels the separation deeply and viscerally. The soldiers gamble for his clothes, completely unaware of what's going on. But Jesus' anguish is palpable. We come to the climax of this awful scene. The physical form of Jesus is exhausted and weak, and yet according to the Gospels, even so, his life is not taken away from him. Rather, with a loud cry, Jesus gave up his spirit. And at this moment, at the moment that this happens, we read that the temple veil was torn in two from top to bottom. Now, this is a little strange to our ears. We can accept that it's some kind of miracle. But what is its importance? Well, the veil separated the holiest part of the temple in Jerusalem from the rest of the world. It was the place where God symbolically lived. The symbolism of this moment, therefore, is that with the death of Jesus, the separation between God and his creation is at an end. Sin is dealt with once and for all, and God's people are free to approach him face to face. We also see signs that death is suddenly, inexplicably working in reverse. As Jesus dies, the earth shakes, the rocks split, and the tombs break open, and we have this strange report that people who were known to be holy have been raised to life. With all this, there is one more bitter irony. Jesus is recognized for who he is, but it's not by his disciples. And it's not by the Jewish people. No, it's a Roman soldier. And not just any soldier. It's the centurion in charge of the crucifixion detail, the man responsible for ensuring that the execution is done, and all three men who are to be executed are certified as dead. Seemingly alone of the people witnessing this strange event, the centurion takes all the strange events of the day and puts them together. In Matthew, we read his conclusion: "Surely this man was the Son of God." The end of the crucifixion story is as anticlimactic as it is sorrowful. One of Jesus' secret disciples among the Sanhedrin is a rich man named Joseph from the town of Arimathea. Somehow, he manages to convince the various authorities to release Jesus' body to him. It happens that, like many rich people at the time, he's been planning for the day when he finally dies, and he has a rock-cut tomb for his body. We have an advantage that Jesus' disciples, including Joseph, never had. For us, the story is complete. We know that although we seem to be at the bitter end, the story is not yet over. It's Friday, but a great and glorious Sunday is coming. As for Joseph, however, the future seems bleak. In line with local customs, he wraps Jesus' body in a linen cloth, and he places it in the tomb. He seals the tomb with a large stone and goes home to mourn the loss of his beloved master. Thank you.